Thank you. Please be seated. The court is now ready to hear arguments in two consolidated cases, both of which are styled Karen Roberts versus Lanny and Casey Williams.
May it please the court, Ms. Mary Olga Ferguson will present our argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honors, we come before the court today, as the court knows, on four concrete issues. We'll focus the majority of our time on the first two issues, and of course as directed by the court. The respondent's burden in the court below was a heavy one. Having settled with four defendants, the respondents were left with the burden of linking what Dr. Karen Roberts did in barely 2 hours of treating this child with the ultimate injury sustained by the child, which did not manifest until 20 days after the child was transferred away from the hospital where Dr. Roberts treated her. The evidence in the record and the evidence presented by the plaintiff's own expert in pediatric neurology confirms that the brain bleeding, which the respondents gave forward to the jury as the only evidence, as the evidence that would have shown up of Courtney's current damages, would have shown up had it been the responsibility of Dr. Roberts within 72 hours of the time she treated the child. And we know from the record, from the plaintiff's own exhibit number 5, that in fact it did not show up for 20 days. And faced with this burden, with this attenuated chain of causation, the plaintiffs made the choice to offer, as their only expert on that causation, a physician who was not qualified to make that testimony before the jury. Your Honors, there were basically three experts that the respondents brought before the jury.
What about the argument that the testimony was cumulative of Dr. Laney?
Your Honor, if we look at what the cumulative testimony was, I think this court said it most succinctly over 100 years ago in the Central Railroad case, when they said that cumulative evidence is evidence of the same kind on the same point. Dr. Laney, in the record at volume 5, at page 152 and 53, specifically refused to offer testimony on causation. In my direct questioning to him, I asked him, can you tell this jury that anything that Dr. Roberts or Dr. Miller did caused or contributed to this child's injuries? And his answer was no.
But the point I thought that was being made is that Dr. Laney, in answer to a hypothetical question, provided causation testimony. And, I mean, historically, that's the only way you get an expert in is through the hypothetical question. So just because Laney didn't say that Miller or Roberts caused the injury, if the doctor testifies, if these are the circumstances that exist and this is the service that's provided, then there's a causation factor there. Then if the other side comes in and says, well, this doctor provided those services and these were the circumstances, haven't you proven causation?
No, Your Honor, and not in this case, because what Dr. Laney said, if we closely examine his testimony, all that he did was speculate about possible causes of the condition, and this court told us in Duff versus Yalen that that is simply not enough.
I thought Laney's testimony was a little bit stronger than that. It wasn't, well, it might have. I thought he said, yeah, if that was the case, it would.
Your Honor, he did say that there may be several conditions that could exist that could all contrive to cause Courtney's injuries. The problem is that one of the conditions he recognized was something over which Dr. Roberts had no control, which was, in fact, a superseding intervening cause, a life-saving treatment that she was placed on over at Arkansas Children's Hospital some 20 days later because she had a problem from birth of continually collapsing lungs, these spontaneous pneumothoraces. That treatment is the only known treatment which could treat that problem this child had at birth. The problem is that it carries with it the risk of bleeding in the brain. And Dr. Laney, sitting before the jury and specifically saying in the record that he had not reviewed records that would allow him to testify as to causation and that he would not do so, the hypotheticals offered, there's no link between
Well, I guess your point would be that that what is missing is not that Dr. Laney said he couldn't testify causation. What you're saying is the record does not demonstrate causation and Laney doesn't provide the missing link, which is something.
Precisely so, Your Honor. Dr. Laney doesn't provide the missing link. It's not disputed And we conceded at the time of trial, and we concede before this court today, that Dr. Laney, as a pediatric neurologist, is eminently qualified to address the issue of causation. He is a Mayo Clinic fellowship-trained physician who could have addressed that issue of causation head-on. The respondents apparently knew that he would not opine, because the medical evidence would not support it, that anything that Dr. Roberts did caused this child's ultimate injury, that it could not be tied. That's precisely the reason we must infer from this record that respondents could not ask him the question directly. Instead, they went to an expert who was not qualified and who had proven to be manipulable at the hands of respondents' counsel in his opinions before. They used someone who should not have been allowed to give testimony to the jury on that point, on either of those issues. Now, the way that we preserved error on this point, Your Honors, and this I think will be a point today, so I address it now, is that we filed two separate motions to exclude the testimony of Dr. McGehee, plaintiff's pediatric expert, prior to trial. The first was a motion to strike his testimony based on the fact that he admitted in his deposition that he had lied in a report filed with the court as required by Article 4590I, Section 13.01, at the behest of respondent's counsel. That motion, as the court will note from the record at Volume 6, page 754, was carried. There was no ruling on that motion. The second motion was a motion to limit Dr. McGee's testimony, as we ask the court to do here today, to the area in which he would be able to testify, general pediatrics. That motion, from the same page in the record, page 754, Volume 6, was denied. And it's on that basis that we come forward to the court, because if we look at the expert testimony that was available at trial, we know that Dr. Laney was there. Dr. Laney was not asked to testify about causation directly. The plaintiffs also embraced as an expert Dr. Kevin Slusher, who was a defendant who settled in this case without being sued, who was later found to bear by the jury 10% of the responsibility in this case, and who had been stripped of his medical license in Texas. And in the respondent's brief at pages 14 through 16, many of the contentions, which I suppose may be perhaps just a scenic behind your question, are echoed by the testimony in the record at Volume 3, page 124, by Dr. Slusher, this doctor with no medical license. The third expert that testified at trial was Dr. McGee, whose credentials we look at today, and the fourth, who testified without objection, who was an expert witness who was simply a subsequent treater of this child, the specialist, the neonatologist who treated this child after she was transferred to the tertiary care facility in Shreveport, Dr. Michael Cohn, who says in Volume 6 of the record, of the reporter's record at pages 32 and 50, twice, without objection from respondent's counsel, that nothing that Dr. Roberts did caused or contributed to Courtney's injuries. And viewing all of those together, we simply ask the court to recognize and to reaffirm its decision in Broders versus Heiss, that while certainly doctors generally possess knowledge that individuals and lay people do not possess, and that while certainly Dr. McGehee can be said to have knowledge of what a general pediatrician would do, he cannot speak to the ultimate issue of causation. And that if he is the plaintiff's only evidence of causation in this case, that evidence is not sufficient under Broder versus Heiss.
Counsel, you have several arguments to make this morning, and one of them is of interest to me, and that's on consortium and on your request that we overrule the Reagan case. And I'd like you to, if you can, address that.
Certainly, Your Honor. Basically, with respect to our request to the court today, there are four things that this court can do. The court can overrule Reagan versus Vaughn, which we've asked the court to do.
Would we need to do that?
Your Honor, the court would not need to do that in this case.
My understanding of your argument was that Reagan versus Vaughn doesn't cover this situation.
Your Honor, it does not cover this situation, and we would not need to overrule Reagan versus Vaughn. We asked the court to do so, to take the opportunity to do what the majority in Reagan versus Vaughn at page 466 of the majority opinion recognized is part of the court's duty to reevaluate the law and the evolution of the law in light of current conditions. And we do believe that current conditions and the medical liability crisis in this state do warrant a closer look at Reagan versus Vaughn.
But isn't that something for the legislature to do as a policy matter? How can we stray from our precedent? And I mean, in terms of the medical liability crisis, we're not to deal with that as a policy board.
Indeed, Your Honor, but respectfully, Reagan versus Vaughn was a case in which this court chose not to leave to the legislature its expansion and its recognition of the parental consortium in the non-fatal injury case was not based on any act of the legislature. It was the court's interpretation.
No, I understand, but you're asking us to rely on public policy to overturn an established precedent of this court, and I don't think we have any authority to do that, do we?
Your Honor, the only authority would be this court's own mandate in the majority in Reagan that asked the court to look to current conditions, which I would assume would include all types of conditions that could impact the litigation in this state, perhaps not only in medical liability, but in other areas, and to look at that in focusing on the continuing evolution of law. And part of that would include whether or not Reagan versus Vaughn is a law which perhaps should be revisited. But Your Honor is correct that with respect to this case, what the court did was specifically extend the holding of Reagan versus Vaughn, which this court has not done, to allow a parent to recover for the loss of consortium of their child. And even the underpinnings in Reagan versus Vaughn do not allow that extrapolation from the court below. Now, the underpinning of Reagan versus Vaughn, quite obviously, and the court said several times that it was comfortable in recognizing that cause of action because obviously children rely on their parents and depend on their parents for support, for sustenance, for guidance. And that in each of those instances, that relationship was deemed worthy of protection by the court.
Did the court deem worthy that both minor and adult children rely on their parents for sustenance and comfort?
They did, Your Honor, and in fact, even though the plaintiff in Reagan versus Vaughn, Julie Vaughn, was a minor, the court went a step further in its holding, and the court there evidenced a willingness to go a step further in its holding to extend the protection for parental consortium to adult children. It did not take the step which respondent asked this court to take today, and that step is to reverse parental consortium and to give consortium for loss of a child's consortium to parents.
But under Reagan versus Vaughn, an adult child that no longer needs the support of the parents for financial, for example, assistance would nevertheless be entitled to recover under that consortium theory recognized there. Why should we not say the same thing here and reject your argument that because there is no shown need for support that there shouldn't be a cause of action?
You should not reject the argument, Your Honor, because, again, the underpinning of the Reagan extension to the adult was based on support. And, in fact, the language of the court was to the effect that even an adult child might need the support or guidance, mental support or guidance of a parent, and that might be a valuable and compensable loss.
With all the discussion now about the baby boomers moving into their mature years, couldn't the argument be made that one of the things that happens is the expectation that children start taking care of their parents? And so you assume, well, we've got a minor child here and then a parent, and therefore none of those things apply. But as the big chunk of the population starts aging, it seems to me the issue kind of reverses, and the children now are looked to support their parents in their advanced years. Is that not a compensable injury under exactly Reagan versus Vaughn, the care and support in their later years?
Your Honor, it should not be. And one of the potential pitfalls with this type of ruling is that when the court, as the majority in Reagan did, asks, is this relationship worthy of protection? There are few relationships that one would count among their loved ones that you could answer that question with a no. There may be many relationships which are worthy of protection, but the real question is, are they compensable, and can we maintain that, and can this court do that without any guiding statute or any guiding act of the legislature? And we would suggest that the court should not do that and follow the lead of, thus far, 28 states. We provided supplemental briefing that includes the case law from all of these states, 28 states that have considered this issue now, the issue of whether or not a parent can recover for loss of a child's consortium, and have rejected.
Have those 28 states recognized it the other way?
Out of those,
as we did in Reagan versus Vaughn?
Actually, Your Honor, it's interesting because 31 states reject the Reagan versus Vaughn holding. 31 states do not have parental consortium. And it's important to tell the court that in those two numbers, the 28 and the 31, we include 7 states which have flatly said they recognize no type of consortium beyond spousal consortium. And that is part of the supplemental briefing. But the overwhelming majority of states reject the approach that the respondents bring forward today, not because the relationship is not valuable, not because Courtney's relationship with her parents is not valuable, but because what we can legally provide recompense for in this state against the backdrop of a crisis which gives us an increase in non-economic damages since the year before the Reagan holding from $318,666 to last year $1.3 million, and a reversal in the majority of non-economic versus non-economic damages in jury awards. And against that backdrop, we would ask that this court reverse the court below.
Is it true that Dr. Roberts equated Courtney's condition as equivalent to cerebral palsy, for example, which would at least suggest that it was a serious and permanent injury that we're talking about here?
Yes, Your Honor, she did. However, what is absent from the record is any testimony from any witness whatsoever that cerebral palsy is severe, permanent, and disabling in every case, that it would have been in Courtney's case. And Your Honor's question raises our third point on Reagan versus Vaughn, that we did ask for the threshold instruction. Is this injury severe, permanent, and disabling? And the court refused that as well.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Rex Nichols, Jr. will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. I'm Rex Nichols, Jr. I practice law here in Longview, and it's my privilege to represent Courtney Williamson. I want to say before I get going that it's also a privilege for me to appear in front of the Supreme Court of Texas. I think that's something that every lawyer, when he starts out practicing, takes as an honor and a privilege.
Mr. Nichols, could you move the microphone up a little bit?
I'd like to start, if the court will indulge me, please. I'd like to follow up on a question that Justice Enoch asked right off the bat. The pediatric neurologist in this case testified, and I'm reading from the record at page 89, I believe volume 5. I asked him this question. I said, I want to ask you a hypothetical question, okay? If I prove to this jury that this child suffered multiple severe hypoxic and ischemic episodes, by the admissions of the doctors that were there time after time over a period of hours, if I prove that, if that is a fact, and then she, that being Courtney, is hooked up to ECMO, do you believe that the combination of those two things is the most likely cause of the bad bleeds and the problems that Courtney Williamson had today? And his answer to that question was yes. I think it's also important to point out to the court, I've provided a packet this morning of some materials. Included in that is a copy of page three of the petitioner's reply brief. And really, for the first time in this court.
Let me ask you this. How do you reconcile that answer with the testimony that counsel read a little earlier that said, I can't offer an opinion on that subject?
Your Honor, what he said was he had not reviewed the records. In other words, he didn't know whether I could prove those things to him or not. And I asked the hypothetical question, well, if I do establish those things, then what is your opinion about the causation of the brain hemorrhages that the child has and the problems that she has today? He says, well, if you can prove those things, and I did, prove that Dr. Roberts was responsible for those things, then he links it up and he says, well, yeah, that's the cause of the problems that she has today.
I understood, Ms. Ferguson, though, to say that one of the elements of the hypothet was an element that was not under the control or services of Dr. Roberts.
Yes, sir, and that's the ECMO therapy, which is a therapy which is basically like a heart-lung machine that a critically ill patient is placed upon to try to salvage them.
And so if you're trying, you might prove that those two circumstances cause this injury, but if you're trying to say that the doctor's actions cause the injury, don't you have to connect the doctor's actions to the hypothet so that Dr. Roberts was responsible for the hypoxia and the ECMO therapy?
Well, Judge, I did that. In other words, there are two answers to your questions. First of all I have to prove is a proximate cause. There doesn't necessarily have to be the proximate cause of harm. If I prove any cause that's a proximate cause, that supports recovery. That's what the pattern jury instructions say. And the second answer is, in the record you'll find testimony that had this child been treated correctly and had she been placed on a helicopter rather than sitting there in Kilgore for 3 hours before they made the call, she never would have had ECMO therapy. That testimony is in the record with both Dr. McGee and Dr. Laney, the pediatric neurologist. In other words, the delay in giving the child the drug that she needed, the delay in making the telephone calls to get the helicopter in the air to get the child out of there, necessitated the ECMO therapy that combined with the other things that went on to cause the brain bleeds. I think it's really important to point out to the court, though, there frankly is a misstatement in their reply brief. They didn't preserve error on this point anyway, and I hesitate to make that argument in some ways because I believe the expert was qualified. He relied on things that I think he's entitled to rely on, like the pediatric neurologist and so forth and so on. But I don't think I'd be doing the job for my client to point out, or if I didn't point out, they simply didn't preserve error. And if I could, I'd like to show the court why. They say in their brief that the court subsequently denied a pretrial motion to limit Dr. McGee's testimony. If you'll look at the court's order, which is also in the little packet of materials on page 2, what the court says is the court will carry defendant's motion to strike plaintiff's expert, Dr. McGee, and allow the defendants to voir dire Dr. McGee at trial to determine his qualifications and ability to testify to certain issues. And there's a mix-up in the order. Quite frankly, the ruling should go under Section 3 there. Of course, I was at the hearing, and I've had the hearing itself transcribed, and today I have attempted to file that with the clerk so that this court can read exactly what happened pre-trial and know what the court's ruling was. But I'll just tell you what the trial court said there.
Well, let me ask you, is what you're about to read from part of the record in this case today?
Judge, it's part of the record I have attempted to file. This is the court reporter's transcript where the judge says, I'm not going to rule on this doctor's qualifications to testify to that issue. I'll let you take the witness on voir dire at trial. And when you take the witness...
Did the Court of Appeals have this transcript before them when they...
Quite frankly, no, they didn't, Your Honor, because this didn't become an issue on proximate causation until it got to this court. As I'm going to point out, and in the packet, the entire argument in front of the Court of Appeals with Dr. McGee was, and the objection at trial, if you'll look at the objection at trial that they made, see, Dr. McGee takes the stand at page 115. He testifies for 35 pages, all along in there about proximate cause. And that's in the packet. You'll see Dr. McGee again and again and again testifies about proximate cause during the trial without any objection whatsoever. And it's not to about 35 pages later that defense counsel stands up, takes the witness on voir dire, and makes this objection. They say, we would ask to exclude the witness's testimony with respect to damages. Obviously, Dr. Laney is going to testify to this. But as far as his credentials to speak to the specific issues of future damage, we feel that he's not qualified in this area. There never was an objection at trial about proximate cause testimony. The ruling at pretrial, the judge said, I'm going to carry that motion until time of trial. That's exactly what he did. He allowed Ms. Ferguson to take the witness on voir dire. She made the objection at trial, but the only objection she made was as to the doctor's ability to testify to future damages, and that was only after he testified for 35 pages about proximate cause.
Let me ask you about the consortium claim. Do you agree that with the petitioner's count of the other state jurisdictions' law on this consortium subject?
Judge, I've read the amicus brief. I'm sure the court has, too. To be honest with you, I have not canvassed all of the other states. I do know this. I do know that every court of appeals in this state that's looked at it, I believe there have been at least three. Austin, the 14th out of Houston, and perhaps El Paso or Amarillo, I'm not sure. But I know three, or Texarkana. I know that the three that have looked at it have all been consistent in saying that, in looking at your decision in the Reagan case, that if we're going to recognize this relationship, it's the relationship upon which Reagan is based that we're going to recognize a loss of consortium between a parent and a child. In other words, if the court's going to recognize the consortium claim from a child to a parent, then it only makes sense to recognize the same claim from a parent to child, because in this court's rationale, I think Judge Phillips wrote the opinion, it's the undeniably unique relationship between a parent and a child. I mean, we're talking about the most fundamental relationship that's known to mankind. For 30 years, this court has looked at and recognized a loss of consortium claim between spouses. We know every day people get divorced and spouses get replaced, but children never get replaced. And what the argument really boils down to is this, is that you can have one day a perfectly healthy child that loves you and jumps in your arms, and I think we've all been there. I've got two kids, and I know some of the members of the court have kids. You have a situation where that child loves you and everything's normal, and then the next day everything changes to where in Courtney's situation, she lays on the ground, she bangs her head on the floor, she tries to bite her fingers in two. She can't have any kind of relationship with her parents.
Do you know enough about the decisions from the other states? Have any of these other states crossed the bridge and acknowledged a loss of consortium claim from parent to adult and then not acknowledged it from adult to child?
Judge, I really can't answer that question. There was an amicus brief that was filed that I believe does answer or address that question. To be real honest with the court, in our particular case, consortium never was a big issue, okay? It was the jury awarded past damages for loss of consortium, but there was only a $1 award for future loss of consortium.
Why do you think that was?
Because that's what I argued, Your Honor. I suggested to the jury that these parents have suffered a loss of love and companionship of this child in the past. I frankly thought it was a good trial tactic to turn around to the jury and say, but these parents are going to love this child no matter what, and that their relationship, by awarding a dollar, you recognize the fact that in the future their relationship is going to be diminished, but on the other hand, you recognize that the parents love the child.
And that may have been a good, without regard to whether that was a good tactic, you could still argue, though, I assume, that the future loss of consortium would be compensation for the loss not as it existed from that point forward, that is, with the disabled child.
Yes, sir.
But as if the child had never been disabled. In other words, in an abstract case, not necessarily your case, but if you had spent already 10 years, if you went to trial 10 years after the child was disabled, you could still claim that you were going to lose consortium for the life expectancy of either you or the child.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And you know, the argument is there. I mean, of course, some of the arguments against the loss of consortium claim are that it's, you know, tough to measure, hard to calculate, the damages are intangible, won't replace what you've lost. And then I guess those arguments carry special strength when you're talking about future damages. Of course, that's the case in every type of a case involving loss of love, companionship, and society. I mean, you've got that in every wrongful death case. You've got the same claim, the loss of love, companionship, and society.
Let me ask you, on that regard, if there is a loss of consortium claim, there's the argument that this ought to be limited to a severe injury, disabling injury.
Yes, sir.
And I understand this child is basically impaired on one half her body and her ability to think, perhaps. And I know there's an argument, well, maybe she'll be more normal, maybe she won't be normal. But if this child is capable of conveying love, if the child is capable of responding to love, if the child's capable of understanding the relationship between herself and her parents, has there been a loss of consortium? And I mean, in wrongful death, it's pretty obvious. You no longer get that relationship. But just because a relationship is affected, shouldn't the jury have been able to decide whether it was affected enough to award consortium under the facts of this case?
Your Honor, if you look at the record, and I would just direct the court's attention to page 14 starting on page 14 of my brief, where we talk about the damage testimony, which was very extensive, as the Court of Appeals found, from Dr. Laney, the pediatric neurologist, that there's not any dispute about. That
I understand the severe injury argument, and I understand the beating her head against the ground and trying to mutilate herself, but in spite of that, is this not a child capable of responding to a parent's love and attention?
Well, Judge, I don't think so. I think effectively that's lost, and that's what the record says. I don't think that there's really any challenge, if you look at the record in this case, that this child's or the parents certainly have a loss of consortium. Now, if the issue is, well, if the child is capable of interacting with their parents at all, should we, as a matter of law, allow a consortium claim, then I would respectfully suggest that that's entirely consistent with 30 years of precedent from this court in a spouse context, okay? In a spousal context, you allow a loss of consortium claim to go to the jury and to be decided by the jury, even though the spouses can interact to some degree.
Did you object to submission of the proposed question on the serious and permanent and disabling injury?
I don't think I objected to it. I think what the trial judge found and what the Court of Appeals found was that simply there was no evidence that anything other than a severe injury occurred to the child. I mean, again, Dr. Roberts characterized the child as one having cerebral palsy that qualified for admission in the Scottish Rites Hospital, which I'm sure is common knowledge to the court. They don't take any children that are not severely incapacitated.
Let me ask you just one other question about the settlement credit.
Yes, sir.
You contend that the court properly applied the credit in accordance with our precedent in CNH, but would you agree with the petitioner that the language of Chapter 33 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code would have required a different calculation?
No, sir, I don't agree with that at all. If you look, and I've gone back and looked at the two statutes, if you look at 33.012, that statute is the statute that calculates the damage cap or the one recovery rule, the common law one satisfaction rule. And as the court did in CNH, you look at that, but that's a separate calculation from 33.013. 33.013 deals with the liability of each individual defendant. And in a case where a defendant is severally liable, all that this court had, and by the way, the CNH decision from this court was unanimous and decided just really a few years ago. I think Justice Heck may have dissented from or concurred with part of the court's decision, but I think you concurred with the majority's interpretation of Chapter 33. The two things are entirely independent of each other, and what I noticed was 33.013 does not say that a defendant's liability is this after you deduct a settlement credit from 33.012. And I'd respectfully submit that the reason the term settlement credit has been used for so long is that for so long in this state we had joint and several liability, and as a practical matter, that's what it amounted to. Because every defendant, as I point out in the brief, prior to 1995, Dr. Roberts would have been jointly and severally liable for the jury's entire verdict. And then, of course, she would have been entitled to take the settlement credits off the total damages, and she'd be responsible for the remainder of that. But in a case where a defendant is only severally liable, as in this case, all she's being required to do is to pay the percentage of damages that she alone caused. I would point out one other thing. In the Court of Appeals, they took the argument again has changed in front of you. In the Court of Appeals, what they said was, well, we think you ought to calculate the percentage, or Dr. Roberts' percentage, 15% times the total damages, and then from that apply 100% of the settlement credits where she doesn't pay anything. And the Court of Appeals said, no, that's not what CNH says. As Justice Phillips writes, I believe, in CNH, he says with the severally liable defendant is liable for their percentage of the damages that they alone caused. And in this particular case, the result of that is that with the settlement credits And with the judgment, if affirmed by this court, this child still ends up with about 30% of the damages that the jury found to exist in this case. 30%. If you apply it the way that they want you to, it's substantially less than that. And I think that the court's, the quote that you had, I don't have it exactly in front of me, but it says pretty much that when we interpret a statute like Chapter 33, we're looking to interpret in a reasonable way, in a way that's fair.
Well, there's no way to. We hadn't found a reasonable interpretation of these statutes yet, but anyway, we're still looking.
Still searching.
Yeah, but one last question on consortium.
Yes, sir.
Does it follow from your argument that consortium should be recovered for the loss of any dear or important relationship?
Absolutely not.
Where would you draw the line?
I think where the wrongful death statute draws the line is a really good way to look at it.
Just because it's traditional? Or?
Well, Judge, it that way it takes care of the people that you know are most likely to have the closest relationship. And I think this court has said before that there's not a good reason to distinguish between the wrongful death statute and the common law. It provides good guidance. It's worked. My experience is that that's the group of people that are most likely to be harmed when the relationship itself is harmed. We're talking about spouses, parents,
well, and, the court
and children.
Well, and the court, too, has done that in the past, specifically. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. In other words, the court in several other contexts has looked to the wrongful death statute as being a good guide for the common law. And in fact, in many cases, I know like the Rose Hospital case, the court has looked and said, well, the wrongful death statute is actually more restrictive in its application than the common law. So I think it makes it has a good guide to make sure that the type of consortium claims that the jury can consider compensating are the kind of relationships that are the closest. And it also makes the law consistent with all wrongful death cases.
Yeah, let me ask you real quick, that handout that you've given us up here on the bench with the testimony, what is this from?
Your Honor, well, there are actually two of them. You have one in front of you, and I wanted to make that clear. These are just selected portions of the record that what I have here. The first page is a copy of the reply brief.
Well, I'm interested mainly in the examination pieces. Are these part of the record that's before us?
Yes, ma'am, they are. These are part of the trial testimony of Dr. McGee, and the reason I gave them to you was to show that he testified on and on about proximate causation, and that the only objection that was made came long after that testimony was in, and it related solely to damages.
But that's all in the record below and before us.
It is. And the other one that you don't have in front of you that I have filed that you can look at is the trial court's ruling on the pretrial motions. Now, see, they say that that's how they preserved error on the proximate causation issue. And if you will look at that, and I beg you to look at it, you will see that what the trial court did was he said, I'm not going to rule on that now. I'm going to carry that motion about Dr. McGee's testimony and how far he can testify and on what. I'm going to carry that to trial, and at trial you can take him on voir dire and make your objection at trial. In other words, there's no ruling at the trial court level at the pretrial stage, and that's how they predicate preservation of error. And that's why I think it's so critical that this court have a chance to look at exactly what happened at that hearing on October the 12th.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. To follow up on.
Could you address the preservation point?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I attempted to do so somewhat ham-handedly before, but perhaps now that the court has seen that issue. If you look at the order that Mr. Nichols has provided, first, it's very important to point out that the transcript of the October 12th hearing is not a part of this court's record and was not part of the record on appeal. That, if you'll notice, was transcribed on April 15th, this past Monday. I know that the respondents have attempted to file that with the court today. We, of course, will be filing a motion to strike that.
But if there was a pretrial ruling on evidentiary matter, wouldn't the court treat it like a motion in limine anyway and say you don't preserve the error unless you object at the time of trial?
Well, Your Honor, according to Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1, all that is necessary is that we either make a motion or an objection and have that ruled on. And if you look at the actual order, which is a part of the court reporter's record that Mr. Nichols has provided in this packet, there is a ruling. The motions, and this was the reason that I attempted to clarify this before, there are two motions. There was a motion to strike based on what we regrettably felt was misconduct. That was a motion to strike Dr. McGee's testimony as a sanction. There was a second motion at that October 12th hearing, and that was a motion to limit his testimony, as we asked the court to do today. Mr. Nichols is correct. The first motion, the motion to strike the plaintiff's pleadings, the motion to strike his testimony, was carried. The motion to limit testimony, item 3 of the order before the court, which is at Court Porter's Record, Volume 5, page 754, the motion is overruled, the motion is denied. And the judge, the trial court there, allowed us to redepose Dr. McGee to learn about the additional areas that he'd be testifying about beyond pediatrics. This didn't obviously...
Assume that's the case. Why wouldn't the court, when you have a motion to limit testimony and the court makes a ruling on it, why wouldn't the court treat that as a motion in limine, which is not... an appealable order. You have to object if, as, and when the testimony is offered.
Well, and we did object to a portion of his testimony, but behind Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1 is the entire motion, basically a Robinson challenge on his credentials to testify. And that was raised in the motion to limit his testimony. We did not ambush the respondents with that at trial. We filed it 2 months before the trial, and the court said that evidence will come in. And rather than showing the jury that we had a serious issue with this expert witness, we chose to rely on Rule of Appellate Procedure 33, that a motion that we had been overruled and denied by the court. And it was on that basis that we preserved error. The Court of Appeals, it's important to note, did not quibble with whether or not we'd preserved error.
Well, by the same token, they didn't deal with the causation issue, which leads me to believe that perhaps it wasn't raised there either. They seemed to only deal with damages.
Your Honor, if you read the appellant's brief below, the language from the motion to strike, to motion to limit Dr. McGee's testimony is precisely the language that we incorporated into the appellate brief, that Dr. McGee was not qualified to testify as to the issues of causation or damages.
But you asked him no questions about his ability to testify as to causation during trial.
Your Honor, we did actually ask him questions that went to that because we went through the questions at the record at page 4 on page 152 and 3 and the reporter's record on page 4 on 155 about his qualifications to deal with the mechanics of neurologic defects.
But then your objection was only as to damages. When you took him on voir dire, but then your specific objection was to his ability to testify about future damage.
It's true, Your Honor, and we did ask him about that as well. And we did object to that as well, but we maintain, and the Court of Appeals did not disagree, that Rule 33 gave us preservation on each of those issues. The fact that the Court of Appeals didn't choose to address causation is not borne out by the fact that we didn't raise causation, because we did at the Court of Appeals. It was causation and damages, because those were the areas beyond.
And they just chose not to write on causation.
I wouldn't speculate, Your Honor, as to what the Court's impetus was there, but the court did not write on causation. But here, when we did raise it, and it wasn't a focus of the oral argument, perhaps some of the arguments have not been here today, but it was part of what we raised at the Court of Appeals and preserved. With respect to Justice O'Neill's question as to the states which have extended parental consortium but have not taken the step that the respondents asked the court to take today, there are 7. Michigan, Montana, Oklahoma, Vermont.
And what's the rationale they use for parsing it?
The rationale is very similar to the rationale of the Reagan versus Vaughn majority, the support and the dependence of the relationship and the legal obligation that accompanies the parent-child relationship.
But had their previous articulation of that relationship been limited to support and not gone as broadly as our cases have?
I can't say that in every single case, Your Honor, but I can say that that most of those dealt with cases where there was already a statute in place where the legislature had acted.
Well, again, more specifically directed at support, and you'd agree that our recognition of this relationship has not been so focused on the support element as it has been the more intangible elements.
It's true, Your Honor, although the court declined to make it a two-way street in Reagan versus Vaughn, even though it did extend it to adult children.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That completes the arguments in the second clause and all of our arguments together. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Please rise. Oh, yay. Oh, yay. Oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.